content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue with the article titled The Fruit Detective by Mark Shapiro, Renaissance Paintings, Medieval Archives, Cloistered Orchards, and How One Italian Scientist is Uncovering Secrets That Could Help Combat a Growing Agricultural Crisis. As we mentioned last time, 6 centuries ago, Italy boasted hundreds of varieties for every fruit, each adapting to specific ecological niches. Apple, pear, and cherry varieties across Umbria were different, in subtle and not-so-subtle ways, from Venetian, Florentine, and Piedmontese varieties. At the turn of the 20th century, the country was home to at least 1,000 pear varieties, according to our scientist, Isabella Dalla Ragione. Today, Italy is one of Europe's foremost producers of pears. Yet, for both pears and apples, a mere 4 varieties each now compose more than 70% of Italy's production, compared with the hundreds of varieties that were common a century ago. The importance of agricultural biodiversity, Dalla Ragione says, can be explained with a very human metaphor, language. She likens biodiversity on a farm to expanding a vocabulary. Conventional agriculture, with its limited genetic range, relies on a narrow vocabulary. Industrial agriculture created a few varieties that are very productive in very precise conditions, with a lot of chemicals and a lot of water. The new varieties may be bigger and have more consistent color, but they have very few genes, few words. Their genetic patrimony is very simple. If you present the right question, they can answer, because maybe they have 4 or 5 or maybe 10 words. But if you present other questions, like drought or climate change or other situations, they have no words to answer. They can't answer because they do not have enough genetic variability inside to answer these questions. Old varieties have a big vocabulary. They have many words to answer these new questions. In order to make use of those genetic answers, however, they need to be rediscovered not only in paintings or musty old feudal inventories, but also in the ground. Biodiversity is dynamic. It cannot be preserved like an object, like a piece of furniture. Dalla Ragione says one afternoon as we drive the winding country roads of Umbria in search of fruit, "You can't restore an ecosystem by putting seeds in a refrigerator." Fortunately, central Italy, one of the country's most fertile regions, has been host to a high concentration of Catholic saints. Saint Benedict, Saint Francis, and Saint Rita all lived in Umbria. As a result, the area is especially rich in monasteries that Dalla Ragione knew had old gardens and orchards that had escaped the farm consolidations over the past half century, thanks to their isolated locations and their unwillingness to sell their land to agribusiness. The monasteries retain considerable autonomy from the Vatican in how they manage their land. So Dalla Ragione began visiting the still active monasteries and convents where she once walked with her father. There she found her long-sought trees, originally planted centuries ago. Often untended for years, they had aged and survived for generations. Many were the direct descendants of the trees in Dalla Ragione's beloved paintings. From their branches hung abundant quantities of fruit, often pockmarked and misshapen, but nevertheless real and sometimes even delicious. In many cases, Dalla Ragione found records and notes about the plants and trees in the gardens. The friars, monks, and nuns had time to write, she says. They documented their cultivations, what they bought, what foods they offered to guests, everything. The modern monastic residents were curious about her interest in old fruits and generous when she asked to take sample cuttings from their gardens and orchards. "I declared immediately that I was not there to pray," she says, chuckling. She returned to her orchard with cuttings from the holy gardens, 3 or 4 each from a selection of figs, plums, and pears, which she grafted onto her own stalks. Dalla Ragione hopes that those humble stalks, in turn, with their age-old resilience, will point toward a sustainable future for Italian tree fruits in a changing climate. At current emission levels, The average temperature in Italy is already breaking records, is headed toward a rise of 2 degrees Celsius or more by 2050 from its pre-industrial average, according to a Europe-wide climate risk atlas. Heat waves will continue to grow hotter and last longer, while the frequency of agricultural droughts at that temperature could increase in Italy by 50%. Last summer foreshadowed those conditions. Searing temperatures and drought devastated many farmers in the area, where Dalla Ragioni does much of her work. Meanwhile, dangerous new fungi, diseases, and pests follow the heat. And the flip side of drought, the product of excess evaporation levels during heat waves, can lead to intense rains and serious floods, as occurred in Tuscany and surrounding regions last spring. Such extremes are bound to accelerate in what scientists warn is a convergence between a climate crisis and a biodiversity crisis. The two are interlinked. Biodiverse ecosystems, enriching and bolstering to soil, are far more resilient to extremes. But Italian biodiversity, like that in the United States and elsewhere, is currently in free fall. Some 42% of Italian plant species in threatened environments faced a risk of extinction, according to the Convention on Biological Diversity, a global agreement that calls for the protection of genetic resources from further ecological degradation. The more genetic erosion, the less we are able to respond to those changes, says Kent Nanadozi, executive secretary of the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. The current system breeds seeds for a set of conditions that are no longer, he says. The first rain used to be assigned to till and plant. Now it could be the first and last rain, or the opposite, too much rain. Climate variability is why we need diverse varieties, those old ancient varieties. To that end, Dalla Ragione's work with Italian regional commissions to boost agricultural biodiversity and Marche, where neighbors are Umbria and Tuscany, Lazio, home to the city of Rome, and Emilia-Romagna, where you will find Bologna, is a response to both crises. In that role, she studies threatened crops, collaborates on ways to conserve varieties, and updates lists of regional crops. She also works with agricoltori custodi, custodian farmers, who receive subsidies to continue growing the old crops, helping to select robust varieties to preserve and cultivate, and helping them tend their traditional orchards and gardens. Meanwhile, she helps others around the world searching for their own ancient varieties. Twice a year, she travels to Lebanon during flowering and harvest times to help resurrect local heritage cherries and apricots. So sweet, she marvels. She was there most recently this July, but had to leave early because of rising tensions between Lebanon and Israel. In Jordan, she has consulted with the agriculture ministry on cultivating indigenous aloe vera plants, and she has helped train farmers in the West Bank in agroecology techniques for resurrecting ancient date palms. In years past, before Russia invaded Ukraine, she also made several research visits to the ancestral homes of the Russian writers Leo Tolstoy and Fyodor Dostoevsky after their estates requested her help reintroducing local apple varieties. Back in Italy, Dalla Ragione is working on resurrecting historic gardens at several 15th and 16th century villas and palazzos in Umbria and Marche. In Palazzo Bufalini, where she had her epiphany about paintings offer critical insights into disappeared fruit varieties, I was able to see the literal fruits of her work. The balcony next to the archives where she commenced her research overlooks the trees she planted about a dozen years ago, now flourishing with apricot, peach, apple, and pear varieties, descended from the varieties they grew during the Bufalini's 16th century heyday. What she's trying to create, she says, are living catalogs of biodiversity in the field. In her own orchard, as we walk along the terraced rows of trees lined with wildflowers and cover crops, and buzzing with pollinating bumblebees and other insects, Dalla Ragione makes it clear that bringing back agrobiodiversity is a meticulous tree-by-tree, fruit-by-fruit, seed-by-seed endeavor. It takes patience, she says. It's kind of like the work of an ant. Ants make very small steps, but they build a kingdom. This place is her realm, and though persistence and obsession, she has more than double the size of the orchard her father planted. There's an apricot tree that could be the same one we'd seen evoked in a fresco attributed to Gentile da Fabriano, and his students, the Seven Ages of Man, painted in 1412 across one wall of the corridor at the Palazzo Trinci in the Umbrian town of Foligno. In the work, each stage of life is represented by a different fruit. And so we stroll slowly past some of those stages. There's a pear tree with thin branches holding tiny fruit barely emerging from the buds, representing infancy. And across from that, a peach tree heavy with small roundish puffs that in the fresco symbolize old age. On the far edge of a small hill, another pear tree, its fruits more elongated, matches the Bufalini fresco. Farther down the scope, in the old part of the orchard planted by Dalla Ragione's father, we find apples, young buds forming for the snub-nosed apples that look like pears, as in the mistakenly labeled Bellini, and the oblong apples at the feet of the Madonna, and the Pinturicchio painting, now dangling midway to ripening from several trees. And here, on the path back toward her house, rests a low-slung bustle of hazelnuts, which apparently represented mature adulthood in Fabriano's day. Nearby are cherries, reddish-white like those we saw in Jesus' tiny hand, growing as tiny buds flickering on the branches. "I'm proud of my roots here in the countryside," Dalla Ragione tells me as we walk the grounds. "These plants are our history. These plants will be our future. 20 years ago, nobody thought about biodiversity. They kidded me. They said, 'You are very romantic to work with these ancient varieties.' Now people understand. We need these old varieties to answer for the problems of the future. Without them, without roots, we are just leaves in the wind." Next, we'll move on to an article titled "Queen of the Klondike" by Melanie Haken. With flinty perseverance and a golden touch, Belinda Mulrooney created an unlikely empire in the frozen north. Exhausted and hungry, the prospectors stumbled into Dawson City in the late summer of 1898 after a grueling journey and found what must have seemed a mirage. Before them towered a three-story hotel, light streaming through the windows from crystal-cut chandeliers and gleaming off the brass and mahogany bar. Inside the Fairview Hotel, its diminutive proprietor, Belinda Mulrooney, preferred menus boasting oysters and steak. Mulrooney's success as a woman and an Irish immigrant with little education was as improbable as the Fairview's remote glamour. Only 26 when she opened the hotel in July of 1898, in 2 years she'd come to be known as the richest woman in the Klondike, overseeing an empire that extended from hotels, restaurants, and real estate development to mining companies, banks, even utilities. It's a swashbuckling story, one marked by constant self-reinvention, that saw Mulrooney help build a city, make and lose several fortunes, and leave a lasting legacy as a Yukon pioneer. Yet Mulrooney's legacy remains little known outside the frozen north. I think she's certainly up there with significant women who had an impact on Alaska, and she hasn't been given the prominence that she deserves, says Joe Antonsen, executive director of the Alaska Historical Society. A true reckoning of Mulrooney's life reveals her as a hero of the frontier, and perhaps its canniest business owner. Born in 1872 in County Sligo, Ireland, Mulrooney stayed behind when her parents emigrated to America and spent her childhood on her maternal grandparents' farm, surrounded by boys. That experience shaped her and inspired her legendary drive. "I never expected any favors," Mulrooney told writer Helen Lyon Hawkins, who conducted a series of interviews in the late 1920s for a biography that was never published. "I knew a woman around men who couldn't do her share is a nuisance and is left behind, so I tried to be in the front always to lead." 13, when she finally joined her parents in the U.S., Mulrooney was unimpressed by life in the coal town of Archibald, Pennsylvania, and soon took a position as a nanny for a wealthy Philadelphia family. After the economic crash of 1891, Mulrooney took her savings to Chicago, sensing opportunity in the city's preparations for the 1893 World's Fair. Mulrooney purchased a lot just outside the fair's carnival strip and built on it, renting and then selling the property at a considerable profit, which she used to buy a popular restaurant nearby. As the fair closed, Mulroney learned that San Francisco was planning its own exposition and took her profits westward, where she repeated her real estate speculations. But when an 1895 fire in an uninsured building left her penniless, it was time to start over. This time, she found success in merchant ventures, bootlegging whiskey and other coveted supplies aboard the steamship City of Topeka between Seattle and southern Alaska, then reselling goods at frontier prices. She opened a store in Juneau and was scanning the landscape for opportunity when a prospector strolled into town, showing off some of the gold nuggets he found in what seemed like a promising strike in the Klondike. Instantly, Mulroney began outfitting for an expedition that would change her life and the frozen frontier forever. Getting to the Klondike goldfields in 1897 required astonishing mettle. The majority of stampeders, as new arrivals were known, came via a brutal overland trek, each explorer hauling gear by sled over the icy 3,550-foot Chilkoot Pass. Mulroney's supplies required 30 such trips. Then came the two-week journey down the turbulent Yukon River to Dawson, for which travelers had to build their own boats. Mulroney landed in Dawson in April 1897, one of the first entrepreneurs on the scene. In an often-told anecdote, Mulroney describes tossing her one remaining coin in the river for luck, announcing with breezy confidence, "I'll start clean." But it wasn't luck that made Belinda Mulroney rich. It was her unerring ability to anticipate what people would most need. Her goods, including hot water bottles for miners, enduring the frigid winter in tents, netted a 60% profit from that first trip. She also saw the miners were desperate for a good meal and opened an all-hours restaurant serving hearty home-style fare. Mulroney's eye for creative reuse proved key in an undeveloped environment where materials were scarce. "I started buying up all the boats and rafts that were arriving, hired a crew of young fellows who had nothing to do, and had them build cabins," she said of her first Yukon real estate venture, which she embarked on shortly after arriving. "Those cabins were soon selling for as much as $4,000 apiece, or more than $150,000 today." Mulroney also had a canny instinct for location. During that first Yukon spring, she scouted ground on which to open her first hotel and chose the junction of two of the busiest coal mining creeks, 16 miles outside of Dawson. The Grand Forks quickly became the miners' primary gathering place and soon doubled as an official collection office for royalties demanded by the Canadian government. At night, Mulroney put the floor sweepings through a sluice, gleaning an extra $100 or so in gold dust daily. Perfectly positioned for intelligence gathering, she invested accordingly and by the end of 1897 owned 5 gold claims, plus almost 20% of one of the region's wealthiest mining companies. Ever the expansionist, Mulroney set out to build the finest hotel in Dawson City, one modeled on the elegant hotels she'd seen in Chicago and San Francisco. Calling it the Fairview, Mulroney was meticulous in choosing the lace curtains, plush carpets, brass bedsteads, and other finery that would make her new hotel the envy of the region's other hoteliers, who housed most guests in rough dormitories. When explorer Mary E. Hitchcock arrived in Dawson in June 1898, she was deeply impressed and detailed her reaction in her 1899 memoir, Two Women in the Klondike. "The menu, beginning with oyster cocktails, caused us to open our eyes wide with astonishment after all that papers had told us of the starvation about Dawson." The Fairview was the first property in town to have electricity. When miners bet Mulroney $5,000 that she couldn't keep the three-story building warm, she bought an old steamboat boiler, attaching a sawmill to provide the fuel. Mulroney modernized the town in other ways, too, helping bring Dawson its first telephone and telegraph, housing the switchboard in the Fairview, and forming the Hygieia Water Supply Company to provide safe drinking water. It was less than 2 years since she arrived in Dawson, and already she was one of its foremost citizens. She really loomed large in the history of Dawson City, says Engaharad Wenz, director of the Dawson City Museum, adding that if we were to credit a single person with bringing the Klondike into the 20th century, Mulrooney was the prime candidate. As sharp-eyed as she was for business, Mulrooney proved less so in matters of the heart. Disaster came courting in the form of a sham European nobleman, quote-unquote Count Charles Eugene Charbonneau, actually a French-Canadian barber from Montreal, whom Mulrooney wed in Dawson City on October 1, 1900. Newspapers around the country published rhapsodic descriptions of the lavish wedding and followed the Charbonneaus on their honeymoon trip of Europe, running photographs of Mulrooney wearing furs and jewels in a mansion the couple rented in Nice. The next few years found the Charbonneaus wintering in Paris, an apartment near the Champs-Élysées with a bevy of servants. But Charbonneau's profligate spending, dubious investments, and mismanagement of Mulrooney's mining companies emptied the couple's bank accounts, leaving the con man in France, where he was soon to be convicted of swindling and embezzlement. Mulrooney returned to Dawson alone in 1904. Forced to start over yet again, she regathered her energies, and in the spring of 1905 followed the next gold strike to Fairbanks, some 400 miles east of Dawson City, buying up claims in partnership with fellow investors. She also purchased several building lots and opened a bank in nearby Dome City. By the time Mulrooney filed for divorce from Charbonneau in July 1906, she was flush once again. Perhaps foreseeing the inevitable bust of Alaskan claims, Mulrooney decamped to Washington State's fertile Yakima Valley, where she ran a 20-acre farm and orchard, built an imposing stone castle, and reigned there into the 1920s. Locals came to refer to her as the Countess Charbonneau, but this attempt at a bucolic life didn't prove profitable. She sold the acreage at a loss, leased the castle, and moved to a modest cottage in Seattle, where she ended her career in humble fashion, de-rusting minesweepers in the shipyards during and after World War II. Though no longer commanding an empire, Mulrooney continued to prize her self-resilience and practical skill. In a photo taken in her 60s, she stands proudly in front of the seafaring equipment she maintained. Still, it was her memories of the Klondike that Mulrooney most prized. Of her fondness for that wild country, she recalled poignantly, "I was young when I went there full of hope." Later in life, Mulrooney took special pleasure in her membership in the male-only Yukon Order of Pioneers, which made an exception for her mining achievements and civic service. In 1957, her money mostly gone, Mulrooney moved to a senior care facility in Seattle, where she died in 1967 at the age of 95. The obituary of the most daring self-made woman of the period read simply, "Born in Ireland, she came to Seattle in 1925. Mrs. Charbonneau was in the Klondike in 1898. Her small footstone in the city's Holyrood Cemetery bears only dates and a name, B.A. Charbonneau." Next, we'll read about Show Me the Money by Sonia Anderson. The Klondike Gold Rush yielded about $1 billion in value in 2024 dollars. Here's how that stacks up. Blubber bucks. The massive whaling industry along the northeastern coast of the U.S. harvested blubber from the sea creatures each season. Around the time of Moby Dick's publication in 1851, American whalers were contributing around $10 million, roughly $408 million today, to the national GDP. Bagging the West. In 1803, France exchanged 828,000 square miles of land west of the Mississippi to the United States for $15 million, around $418 million today. The sale put a definitive end to Napoleon's dream of a French empire in North America. Showboat. One of the world's priciest super yachts, the Eclipse, is owned by a Russian businessman and valued at $1.6 billion. A super yacht is a whopping 533 feet long, 58 yards longer than a football field, and boasts two swimming pools and two helipads, plus a miniature submarine for casual undersea excursions. Play ball. In 2020, the wealthy Wilpon family sold the New York Mets for $2.4 billion, the most expensive purchase of a franchise to date in Major League Baseball. Buy me the moon. NASA's Apollo mission cost an estimated $355 million in 1969, about $3 billion today, Before stepping out of the lunar module, Buzz Aldrin took communion, modest wine and bread in a priceless venue, the Golden State. During California's gold rush, hopefuls came from as far as China. In 1852, the most profitable year of that boom, miners harvested $81 million worth, or $3.3 billion today. Next, we'll move on to another article by Sonia Anderson titled One for the Books, The Savvy College Librarian Who Helped Create an Iconic New York Museum. Toward the end of the 19th century, J. Pierpont Morgan, the Gilded Age's Wolf of Wall Street, used some of his wealth to amass a vast collection of books and art. He soon realized it needed a home and a skilled caretaker. In 1905, Morgan's bibliophilic nephew recommended one of his co-workers in the library at Princeton, Belle DaCosta Green. Summoned to an audience with the financier, she impressed Morgan and soon moved into an office in the newly constructed building known as Mr. Morgan's Library in Midtown Manhattan. She would remain at its helm for nearly the rest of her life, and after Morgan's death in 1913, she led the effort to make his vast private collection accessible to all. Now, with the Morgan Library celebrating its centenary as a public institution, Green is honored in a special exhibition. As co-curator Erica Cialella says, there's no real way to talk about the history of the Morgan Library without talking about Belle DaCosta Green. Born Belle Marion Greener in 1879 to an elite black family in Washington, D.C., Green was raised by a single mother who eventually moved the children to New York City, shortening their last name. To improve her children's prospects, Green's mother decided they would pass as white. Green's true race would remain a family secret until nearly 50 years after her death. Having honed her librarian skills in summer school at Amherst College and at Princeton, the self-christened Belle DaCosta Green was brilliant as Morgan's personal librarian, cataloging his collections, guiding acquisitions, and helping scholars sift through the library's holdings. When Morgan died, his son Jack inherited most of the collection on the condition that he made it publicly available. In 1924, the Pierpont Morgan Library opened its doors with Green as its inaugural director. She was pioneering in the way that she went about librarianship, Cialella adds, noting that Green was building a prominent career at the time when women lacked basic civil rights. She was one of the highest paid women in the country in the 1920s. So to have that kind of clout and be able to say, what I'm going to do with that is advance access to research, it's incredible. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.